Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. I'd like to take you back in time, just for a moment, to the year 1962, 50 years ago. That's the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the year Johnny Carson first took over The Tonight Show. And what's for dinner? Well, probably some kind of meat and potatoes in the oven, some vegetable out of a can. If you're in a rush, you might be eating TV dinners, which can be ready in just 40 minutes. What there is not is a great deal of creativity in many American kitchens. Many homemakers are intimidated by the idea of elaborate cuisine. The food they cook and the tools they use to cook it are based on convenience, simplicity. It's almost utilitarian. But that's about to change as a 6'3" woman with a voice that one TV executive would later describe as a cross between Tallulah Bankhead and a slide whistle is about to make her television debut and show viewers in Boston how to cook an omelet. And so, the force of nature known as Julia Child was introduced to the world on public television. Her book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, was a hit, and at the age of 50, she found her calling and helped usher in a new era of cooking at home and on TV. But despite how we all may remember her, Julia Child did not enter this world fully formed, and that fact is carefully considered in Bob Spitz's book, Deary, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob Spitz, welcome to Focus.
Craig, nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Glad to have you with us. And as we discuss the life and legacy of Julia Child, we also welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And we also welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Bob, it's kind of hard to imagine how much of a revelation Julia Child was when she first burst onto television back in the early 60s, but there was no Food Network, no cooking demonstrations on morning news programs, really no cooking on TV of any kind.
Right. She came out of nowhere. Took everybody by surprise, and especially considering her presentation on TV. It was very rudimentary. This was a woman who had no media training whatsoever, so she talked with a savage warble. She had no battalion of stylists. I mean, I think Julia wore the same three blouses for 30 years. She just took over the networks by being herself completely, and that was her magic.
Why do you think viewers immediately took to her? Was it that
they
authenticity?
It was. You know, as I said, she was really unpretentious. It was like, you know, getting a cooking demonstration from your maiden aunt or a neighbor over the clothesline. You know, Julia made no judgments on anybody. You know, she knew that that cooking for most people was difficult, was tedious, and she wanted to make it easy, and so she did, and that took the onus off everybody, and I think people just completely fell in love with her.
How was food, as generally prepared in U.S. homes, different before and after Julia Child's emergence on TV?
Well, it was very much as you said in your introduction, Craig. Julia appeared at a time when Americans were really relying on casseroles, you know, casseroles with condensed soup in them, and tuna nuda casseroles, and all kinds of glutinous things. Jell-O molds were very big in those days, and anything you could throw together quickly. Everything was done for convenience in the late 50s as we moved into the early 60s. But, you know, everything took a turn when the Kennedys came to the White House. All of a sudden, they had a French chef, and Jackie wore French clothes and spoke perfect French. And so the table was set. We were ready for something else, something different, and Julia came through with the classic French cooking.
Now, as I said, Julia Child did not just appear fully formed. In fact, it took her quite a while to sort of discover her passion. Would it be fair to characterize her as one of the more famous late bloomers of the 20th century?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very good way to put it. She had a childhood that was just kind of stumbling through the wilderness. She called herself a social butterfly because she thought that's all she was. And in fact, she was something of a dilettante. She was a rich girl. She didn't really study much in college. In fact, I think she majored in carousing. It was during the Depression, and Julia, in college, knew where every speakeasy was, and that was her expertise in college. When she got out, she still had no idea what she wanted to do, and thanks to World War II, at least, Julia, you know, went to work for the war effort and began to get her focus. She found herself in Southeast Asia as a part of the OSS.
And this is the Office of Strategic Services. What was the OSS? This is sort of the precursor to the CIA?
Oh, absolutely. It was America's premier spy network, and it was headed by a guy named Wild Bill Donovan. Donovan created America's spy networks, and Julia found herself not only working for the OSS, but in Donovan's office, and got transferred with him over to Southeast Asia. She wound up in Ceylon. People always ask me, was Julia a spy? And I put that question to her because I knew her quite well. And she kind of laid it out for me. She said her job was to head something called the registry. And the registry really knew where every spy, American spy, was in Southeast Asia during World War II. She gave all the spies their code names. She knew their movements. She reported them back to the generals. So was Julia Child a spy? I don't think so. But was she in the spy business? Oh, you bet she was.
Well, she always sort of publicly characterized herself as a glorified clerk. Was she underselling her role, you think?
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. No, Julia was a clerk of sorts, but only in the sense that she amassed all this information and kept it filed. She was privy to pretty much the entire spy network in Asia during World War II.
What made her a useful resource or a person that you know was valuable within the OSS during that time? What about her personality?
She was just lucky. The OSS was hiring smart young college graduates, and she was one of them. What made her useful was that she was incredibly organized, and we would find that out later on in her own career, how organized she was, and how resourceful she was. She found out that, believe it or not, she was a self-starter. She may not have done it in college, but she could do it. She could do it working for the government, and she started to discover herself slowly but surely.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the legacy of Julia Child on today's show with Bob Spitz. He's author of a new biography entitled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. We welcome your questions and comments about America's first great TV chef and her interesting life and career at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. All right, so Julia finds herself, at this point, this is Julia McWilliams, you know, this is before she's met her husband Paul and before she
exactly
becomes Julia
right.
Child.
Yep.
She spent a great deal of time overseas through her work with the OSS. Do you think that impacted how she viewed what sort of role she might ultimately play in the world?
Not quite yet, but I think what it did make her was worldly. It started to unlock Julia's curiosity, and Julia had tons of curiosity. I was really fortunate to look through all of her early diary entries and her journals, and she had an incredibly inquisitive mind. She just didn't know how to put it to use. Once she saw Ceylon and then later China, where she was stationed, she started to experience different kinds of people, look at different kinds of cultures, try different kinds of foods, and that was the start right there of unlocking what was deep inside of her that would come out later.
I'm noting that I was just writing down the phrase you used, the fact that she had an inquisitive mind but didn't know how to put it to use. Couldn't you say that for a lot of people?
Without a doubt. But I think with Julia, maybe it went on a little longer. When she got out of college, I mean, she was a socialite. You know, she had no idea what she was going to do. She went to New York. She basically failed in her attempt to become a writer. She Took the test at the New Yorker, didn't pass it. Took the test at Newsweek, didn't pass it. Had an assignment for Saturday Review, got rejected. So it was a little more than all of us who are looking for ourselves after school. Julia truly had no ideas. I mean, she really didn't. But she was open to anything. And so I think that's what saved her in the end.
And then while in the OSS, she met Paul Child. You write that ultimately it was their mutual love of food that sort of brought them together. How so?
They could not. Paul loved food of all sorts. And Julia had never met a person who really talked about food the way Paul did. He had grown up for part of his life in France and really knew French food. He had taught in Italy and had a very good understanding of Italian food. And Julia was really drawn into this man who talked about food the way some people talked about art or sports. He was entranced by it. Also, he took her to little local places in Ceylon, places that other people in the military were not allowed to go to. So they had to sneak off the base. And the reason they weren't allowed to go was because some of those restaurants served cat on the menu. Mm. And the military had made those off limits. But, you know, Paul wasn't to be dissuaded, and he dragged Julia along. And over the course of these fantastic dinners, they started a relationship that became a relationship for the ages.
Yeah, I was going to say, if these two had not met and fallen in love, do you think Julia Child, the icon we all remember, the name aside, would have found her way to her life's calling?
Perhaps not. Paul was definitely her mentor, her muse, someone who encouraged her and really instilled in her everything that she later had. I mean, when Paul met her, he wrote in a letter to his brother, who he wrote to often, "I've met a woman pretty interesting, but she's an empty vessel." He really felt she was unsophisticated. In one letter, he said, "Don't think there's much going on upstairs."
Hmm.
He took this empty vessel and he began filling it up. I mean, really, he introduced her to art and literature and philosophy and history and politics. And Julia was ready for this. She was ready to devour the world. Nobody had ever intrigued her about it the way Paul did. And, of course, about food. So in answer to your question, Craig, I would say without Paul Child, Julia might be the wife of some socialite. In fact, her father was setting her up to marry the heir to the Los Angeles Times, a man she found just incredibly boring. But she might have wound up with him otherwise.
I was struck in reading your book how after World War II, both Julia and Paul kind of find themselves in this sort of aimless phase, this same situation where they both have demonstrated this insatiable curiosity about the world. They've learned about the world. They've traveled around the world. But they're not really sure what to do with all of that.
Exactly right. Yeah. Paul was a really remarkable guy. He was a Renaissance man in many respects. Long before that term came into fashion, he was a fantastic photographer. He had photographed with Man Ray and photographers of that stature. He was a fantastic painter. I mean, really a remarkable painter. He had made the stained glass windows in the American Chapel in Paris. He knew the Hemingways quite well. He was part of the Gertrude Stein Salon. But here was a man just anchored to the bureaucracy. He was a low-level bureaucrat. And he didn't know where to take his career. And Julia, too. I mean, they left the OSS, and there was a big question mark. You know, what do we do next? And it was only by virtue of Paul's next posting that they found themselves somewhere else. And that posting, where does it happen to be? Well, Paris. Where else?
And I want to stop there just for a moment. A reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Bob Spitz. He's written a new biography about Julia Child, the famed television chef who brought French cooking into American households beginning in the 1960s. We welcome your questions and comments about Julia Child's life and legacy at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. So, Bob, okay, post-World War II, Paul Child takes this job, stationing him in France, in Paris. The Childs ultimately then, November 3rd, 1948, they go to lunch in Rouen. What's significant about that meal?
Well, it changes everything as we will know it from then on. And it's just like, you know, in the movie with Julie and Julia. Paul decides to take Julia to her first French meal. And he's been jabbering about French food since they've met. Now they're married, and he continues to talk about French food. They get off the boat in Le Havre from New York. They drive straight to Rouen. He had a Michelin guide, and he had his eye on a restaurant there called Restaurant La Couronne, right in the square where Joan of Arc was supposedly killed in 1471. And it's kind of an unremarkable restaurant, but, you know, one of those kind of, you know, hotel restaurants. And Julia sits down to a meal that Paul orders for her. And with the first forkful, I mean, that's it, Craig, right there. That first forkful, she was already Julia Child, but she becomes Julia Child with that first forkful of sole meunier. She puts it in her mouth, and she realizes that this is the most incredible thing she's ever tasted. She always said it was the most exciting meal of her life, and she knew she had to do something with food. That would be it.
You mentioned the movie, Julie and Julia, that was filmed just a couple of years ago in which Meryl Streep portrayed Julia Child. How accurate would you say that film was in terms at least of how it portrayed Julie and Paul Child's lives starting at that moment and then leading up to the point of publication of her book?
You know, I have to say it was pretty accurate. I actually saw it while I was researching my book, and I had been researching it for 2 years, and I was immersed in all of Julia's papers, and I was convinced, 2 minutes into it, that I was watching her on the screen. They took that mostly from the Julia part of it, from Julia's lovely memoir, My Life in France, and I'd say it was pretty accurate. They captured her pretty well.
So that
it was the Julie part that I kind of objected to.
I think there were a lot of people I heard that a lot from critics who said, well, watch for the Julia Child stuff. The rest, not quite as interesting. But then,
yes, and Julia felt the same way. I mean, she never saw the movie, of course, but contrary to public knowledge, she actually did meet Julie and did not go so well.
Well, in any regard, one is this larger-than-life personality and one is someone who people didn't really know that well.
Right.
So I'm sure that's part of it. Okay, so that meal in 48 and subsequent meals then sort of awakened Julia Child's passion for French cooking. How did she seek to satisfy that passion?
Paul suggested that she go to Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. It was very, very little known at that point. It was just a small school that catered to housewives and nannies and they certainly didn't have many Americans there at the time, certainly no American women there. And Julia fell under the tyranny of a despotic headmistress, Madame Brissart, who did not want her in that school. Not a big woman. She didn't want a big woman, certainly not an American woman. So she put her into a class with 11 American GIs. And these were guys whose food, I can only say, could best be described as grub. They were guys who served the swap lines in the Army and now wanted to go back to America and become short-order cooks or open up little cafes at golf ranges. And Julia was lucky enough that the mentor, head chef in the class, became a mentor to her. And really took her aside and taught her the finer aspects of French food. And that did it. I mean, that was it. Julia was just, again, I hate to say it, just like in the movies, you know, she would study in that class. She would go home, recreate the recipes and for Paul when he came home for lunch. And she would work all day, practicing them over and over and over again until she got them right. She was relentless.
Was she ultimately embraced by the French chef community? I mean, I think in terms of the fact that eventually she would later host a TV show called The French Chef. She was not French. She was teaching French cooking. But was she characterized by people in France who were ensconced in the French culinary culture as one of them or as an outsider?
Basically as an outsider. She, as you said, she was not a chef by any sense of the word. And they really didn't know her over there. They still don't know her, even though she got the Legion of Honor. Most people don't know who Julia Child is. She was an American phenomenon. And that's because the food that she was presenting to us as gourmet food was really everyday food in France. People had been making it for years in their homes. And also for the fact that there were no women at the time, none whatsoever, working professionally as chefs in France. It was a man's world, and it was something that bothered Julia for the rest of her life. Wherever she went, she made sure that there were women in the kitchen. She would rush right into a kitchen and say, "How many women are in here?" She'd want to know in every restaurant. So she wasn't embraced. Not at the beginning, and really not at the end either.
I guess we can't really talk about Julia Child without talking a little bit about her unique voice and her unique physical stature. I mean, she was 6'3". How did that impact her life up to this point that we're talking about, the first half of her life, before she really becomes known in the world as Julia Child?
Well, you know, she came from a family of very tall people in which she was one of the smaller, especially with her siblings. Her brother John was 6'5". Her sister Dorit was 6'6". So Julia was used to being around tall people, but it did have an impact on her. She could never get clothes that fit her. Her mother always had to take her to a special place for them. And after she got out of college, you know, Julia didn't have many dates because of her size. She was unlucky in love, and this was at a time when all the, I would say that, you know, 90% of the women who graduated from Smith when she was there all proceeded to get married right after after college. So I would say that that had an impact on her, but it really worked to her benefit later on. When she came into a room, she really entered a room, and she found when she got to New York that there was another big personality just like her, Jim Beard, and they were both kind of the same size. They were that tall, they were that big, and their personalities were as big as they were. So I think it worked for her as much as it worked against her when she was younger.
And what about that voice?
You know, that voice, it's funny. Her niece, who helped me with some of my research, has the same voice, and she told me that it's a child family trait that comes from these very tall people having really long vocal cords, and in their family they call it hooting. So, you know, it was something that they were used to, but the rest of the country wasn't used to it. Julia was always parodied for her voice.
Well, in fact, lampooned maybe most famously by Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live. What was her reaction to that sort of lampooning?
Well, you know, it's funny. Julia didn't care for parodies and lampooning because they always went for the voice. And Julia didn't think she had a funny voice. She couldn't understand it. But when she saw Dan Aykroyd's parody, she loved it. She loved it because it was dark, and that really appealed to Julia's sense of humor. She had a great, wacky sense of humor. And as a matter of fact, she had a video cassette of that, of Dan's parody. And for the rest of her life, she showed it to everybody who came to visit her at her house. She would make them watch it, and then Julia would go reenact it in her kitchen. She would, you know, fall over the counter and go, "Save the liver," and pretend that she was dead. And crack up afterwards. She loved every minute of it.
Some public figures do not like to be lampooned by Saturday Night Live.
They don't, but, you know, it's funny. I spoke to Dan about it afterwards, and he said that it was he was so happy to hear that was her reaction to it. He had never been told that, because it was a parody that was very close to his heart. His Aunt Ellen was considered the Julia Child of Canada. So Dan grew up, you know, eating great French food and watching Julia on TV with his Aunt Helen, and he... That came right from the heart, although he didn't write it. It was actually, the skit was written by now Senator Al Franken.
We're discussing the life and legacy of Julia Child on today's program with Bob Spitz. He's the author of Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. The book explores not only Julia Child's more famous second half, but also the lesser-known first half of her life, including formative years when she was seeking her ultimate calling and her time doing, among other things, significant work for the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. And we will now, as we're closing in on the second half of her life, in the second half of the show, we'll talk some more about Julia Child and take your phone calls. But first, a short break. This is Focus.
This is WILL station manager Bob Culkeen. Our fall pledge drive concluded with outstanding support from you, our listeners. You raised more than $107,000 for WILL, Illinois Public Media, your local public radio station. Thank you to the 758 listeners who made a pledge of support during the drive and to our sustainers, underwriters, and friends. Your continued support is greatly appreciated and helps us maintain quality programs that we bring to you every day. Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the 4th Annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, November 2nd and 3rd in downtown Urbana, with over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music. The festival also features storytelling, Saturday workshops, and family activities. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Bob Spitz. He's written a new biography about Julia Child, the television icon who introduced French cooking into American households beginning in the 1960s. Bob Spitz has previously written about the Beatles, among other nonfiction books. His latest is entitled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. To join our conversation, you can call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll begin this morning with Steve in Champaign. Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Joining the conversation rather late, so excuse me if you guys covered this, but I'm in my late 50s, and I was enjoying the comments of your guest as far as Julia Child and the input of TV in the early days. As a child, my mother used to watch this cooking show. The gentleman's name was Pope. I don't know his first name. His daughter had a certain claim to fame. Carmelita Pope used to sell this cooking spray called Pam, but I know in the 50s, late 50s, TV, of course, was coming into every household, and my mom picked up quite a bit from this cooking show, and I was just wondering if your guest had any could remember this guy at all, you know, or if this person had any impact on Julia Child.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
I can tell you, yeah. Actually, I do know who that person is. He had a cooking show in Los Angeles, and it actually ran for about 20 years. It was kind of a mom-and-pop type cooking show, and it was one of those early shows that, you know, had like a Hey Gals type of theme to it. You know, things were, everything was store-bought or did come out of a can. You know, there was an entire slew of that, and there was one in almost every city in America, but nothing that really showed us how to make food from fabulous, fresh ingredients with the highest quality ingredients. And that's what Julia brought to the game. She was the first one who really told you how you could make impressive Escoffier-type recipes by going to the supermarket and buying great ingredients. So that was the change.
Would you say what cooking was on TV prior to Julia Child was more about the products that were being hawked than the craft of cooking?
Quite a lot of it. And it was the one thing that always bothered Julia about James Beard. And it was the reason he never caught on as a TV chef. He was one of America's great cooks, but he sold himself out as a shill to almost every company that crossed his path. And for some reason, that just didn't fly with where things were going and heading. And people wanted something more than that. They wanted something that was a little more genuine, and she was the real McCoy.
Let's go next to Diane in Champaign. Hi, Diane.
Hey, how are you?
Well, how are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to make a comment about the acceptance in Paris of Julia Child. And around the time she died, I was in Paris at a big trade cookware shop, the Hillerand. I don't know if you noticed, in the first arrondissement near Les Halles. And they had a photo of her over the cash register that must have been 24 by 18.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite impressed with that. And I just thought, some people certainly thought a lot of her there.
Well, I can really comment on that. She wasn't really known among the chefs and people in restaurants, but the cookware stores knew her quite well because Julia would make pilgrimages to Paris, well, throughout her entire life, to buy cookware. She couldn't get over the shops there. Delaran was her favorite. And they also have a picture of her, and she was very well known in that regard. So I think that the people who were the nuts and bolts people of food knew who she was, but she was rejected more or less by the professional cooks.
Diane, thanks very much for the comment. We appreciate it.
Yes, thanks.
You know, that reminds me, at the beginning of the show, I was talking about 1962 when Julia Child first went on the air with her first cooking demonstration. And you describe it in some pretty vivid detail. It was at WGBH in Boston. And one of the first things that occurs to me is that she stressed the need for an omelet pan. And it reminds me that it's not just a question of she changed how people cooked in terms of the food that they prepared, but the tools with which they prepared it.
Without a doubt. As a matter of fact, Craig, when she stressed the need for an omelet pan in that show, there wasn't an omelet pan to be found anywhere in Boston. 2 weeks later, every hardware store in Boston was selling omelet pans. I mean, that's exactly how her popularity was. A garlic press? No one had ever heard of a garlic press before. When Julia used it, all of a sudden, everybody was using garlic presses. And, you know, she introduced food processors on TV. But the interesting thing that we should also note is that Julia never took promotional money for her entire life. I mean, she refused to do it. She didn't quite refuse. She'd say, oh, absolutely, you know, send your product over. But I'll tell you right now, if you do and I don't like it, I'm going to tell people I hate it on the air. So they never sent it, and she knew they wouldn't because she wasn't about to take promotional money. And so when you look at those old videos of Julia, you'll see that the herbs have no labels on them. When she was using an olive oil, she turned it around so you couldn't see the label and you couldn't identify the brand. Even her food processor, she turned around so you couldn't see the name on it. She wasn't about to promote anything for anyone. And that part of the reason is because she was on educational TV, and she felt she had to remain pure and keep it completely non-promotional.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest today is Bob Spitz. He's written a new biography about Julia Child, the television icon who introduced French cooking into American households beginning in the 1960s. Bob Spitz has previously written about the Beatles, among other subjects, and his latest book is entitled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. We welcome your questions and comments about Julia Child. Depending on your age, you may have some very vivid memories of her and maybe even learn to cook from her. let us know. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. I suppose we should take a little bit of time to talk about her book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, on which a lot of the recipes she presented on The French Chef were based.
Right.
How did that book ultimately come to be?
Well, Julia got dragged around to a lot of ambassador and bureaucratic parties when she was with Paul in Paris, and they got on her nerves after a while. And just when she was about to swear them off, she was taken to a party and introduced to a woman named Simone Beck, a French woman originally from Normandy who was living outside Paris. And she and a friend named Louise Bertol were trying to cobble together a little cookbook called French Cooking for American Housewives. And it was no more than a pamphlet at the time, but it was an idea that they had that they wanted to enlarge on. And they hadn't had such good luck. Their French was... their English wasn't great, and so they needed an American to really spruce up the language in the book and turn it into something more than just a little pamphlet. And they asked Julia if she was interested. Well, this is what she had been waiting for years. She now, at this point in her life, was a pretty good cook. She had taken a lot of lessons at Le Cordon Bleu, and she was turning out good food. But she always considered herself a teacher, above all, and she wanted to teach through cookbooks. It was a great opportunity, and so they formed a partnership. Simone, who Julia and everyone else called Simca, had all the recipes, maybe 600 of them, many from her family, which was an old Norman family. And Louisette was a pretty good cook with recipes, too. And so they brought the recipes, and Julia brought everything else, which was not just the writing, but the exactitude and the testing, the relentlessness, making sure that it was right, organizing those recipes. They turned it into what became probably the most important treatise on French cooking in the English language in modern times.
Going back to that first demonstration she gave on TV back in 1962, one of the facts you note is that there wasn't any time or any effort at rehearsal in advance, but it occurs to me she had been rehearsing for that role as a TV chef for many years.
I guess she was, yeah.
I mean, in terms of that relentless practice of developing the craft of these recipes and making sure that they were precise. The impression that I get, and tell me if this is wrong-headed, is that there were other publications of that era of cookbooks where maybe that sort of relentless testing didn't take place.
Yes, and I would say you would be right in almost 95% of the cases. Recipes were horribly written in those days. In fact, in many of the cookbooks, they didn't even offer specific measurements. They just said, you know, a pinch of salt, throw in a couple handfuls of flour. They were that vague. Julia, you know, I can't emphasize that word relentless too much. She was that and more. Julia wasn't just happy enough to write about, you know, having a certain meat in a recipe. Julia wrote to the U.S. Department of Agriculture so that she knew the fat content in every portion of every kind of cow. She was a pen pal with the Department of Fisheries. I mean, she wanted to know the kind of water, the kind of that they swam in, where they came from, how they bred, the sizes of different fish. When Julia tested roast chicken, which she thought was the ultimate recipe that everyone should know how to make, she made 50 of them. I mean, she made them trussed and untrussed, stuffed and unstuffed, standing up, lying down, in an electric oven, in a gas oven, at every temperature, until she developed a recipe that she thought she could put in the book. And it was that kind of testing that she did in almost every recipe before she would agree to put it into print.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Bob Spitz, author of the biography Deary, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again are 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. We had one caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to ask you about Julia Child's relationship with Jacques Pepin.
Well, it was a lifelong relationship with Jacques Pepin, and it was quite a humorous one. I've kind of tried to lay it out in the book as much as I could. Julia loved Jacques, but they also cooked very differently. And they were both kind of strong-headed about and bullheaded about the way they cooked, so neither was willing to give in to the other's whim. And when they started to cook together on those great shows, Cooking with Julia and Jacques, they would do things like try to sabotage each other off screen. When people weren't looking, when Jacques wasn't looking, Julia would throw more salt or butter into his recipes. And he would do the same to her. And you know, when they came off screen, Jacques was so angry, he always wanted to put a fist through a wall. And then they'd call action, and Julia would go, "Oh, Julia, my love." They really liked each other a lot. They liked to needle each other, and they had a really good time doing it. So I think they had a lot of respect for the way each other cooked.
Let's take another call. We have Patsy on the line from Champaign. Hi, Patsy.
Hi. I'm an old lady, but I was a young mother at one time, and I watched Julia, and just making a comment about her. I was very uptight about my cooking, and I thought everything should be perfect, but watching her, she was a marvelous cook. I realized she slopped things over the pan. You know, she dropped things. She didn't seem to have it together, but obviously she did. And I learned from that, you know, you shouldn't get uptight about what you're doing, because Julia, you know, didn't have a perfect counter and a perfect attitude like some cooking shows do now. So I loved her. And in fact, somebody said to me once, you know, you look like a young Julia Child.
Oh.
So that was quite a compliment to me. So that's all. Just loved her and loved that movie that was made recently. Was it that accurate?
Well, we were talking about that earlier, and Bob, you said you think it was pretty accurate.
I was. And, you know, Patsy, you were exactly right when you talk about the way Julia cooked. She was precise in her measurements, but Julia liked to enjoy herself in the kitchen. And, in fact, whenever anybody came to dinner at her house, and they came often, Julia got everybody into the act. You couldn't come to Julia's for dinner unless you would help with the preparations. Whether you were a great chef or just someone who was a backyard barbecuer, she just believed you should have fun and take it easy. And you know, she had another rule, and she lived by it her entire life, and that is never apologize. If you go horribly wrong in the kitchen, you just serve that dinner, you just put it out there, don't apologize, look that guest right in the eye, smile at them, and eat your food, no matter how horrible it is.
That's a great one, because I have trouble with that. I'd apologize one side, and you know. So let's forget about my dinner and send out for pizza, okay, everyone.
Right.
But you know, I wish I had known her. That would have been such a thrill to.
But you see, you did know her. You knew her like everybody else.
Yes, yes.
And everybody thought they knew her too, because she looked directly at you when she was on TV,
yes,
and
she
talked to you the way just a friend would talk to you as well.
Right, and the batter was just dripping out of the bowl. Okay,
she was
thanks.
A character. That
was a great show, thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. Yeah, I guess we could sum up her attitude as what happens in the kitchen stays in the kitchen.
Exactly right.
Let's next go to Ken in Champaign. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, I was looking at the show. I'm not sure exactly the year, but I was in Chicago with some friends at a restaurant in the Drake Hotel, and I don't recall what the restaurant's name was, or, you know, but they had a number of restaurants there, for late dinner, and only a few people there, and the buzz among the waiters was, oh, Julia Child is here, you know, she's cooking, I mean, she's eating here, you know, that kind of thing. She's way off someplace. I didn't go and, you know, bug her and, you know, whatever, but they were thrilled. It was amazing. The other one, recently, you know, he had, Will had, the PBS here, had the, some of her early shows, and I think the Omelet Show is a classic. You know, she has them all over, and just wonderful. So, anyway, that's just my small tidbit. But
all right. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Well, I'll tell you also, Julia always turned heads when she ate out in a restaurant because everybody in America knew who she was, and she liked to eat out. And she also liked to make sure that chefs felt really at ease when she walked into their restaurant. It wasn't a test, and she was appreciative of anything anybody made for her.
What lessons do you think we can draw from Julia Child's life and specifically second half of life success?
Well, I mean, there's so much to draw from her. One of the things we didn't talk about that we should all know is that we kind of owe Julia the creation of PBS. When Julia started on TV, there was no network, really. It was just a handful of educational TV stations, and they didn't know each other. When Julia's show started to become successful on WGBH, they made a tape of it, and they sent it out to a few of those stations and said, here, you might like to show this. That is the beginning of an educational TV network right there. That was it. That was the start of what they called NET. Once those other stations put Julia on, it became a network, and NET evolved into PBS. This is before Sesame Street, before Mr. Rogers, before Masterpiece Theater. It was Julia Child that really helped create that network. So we owe her that. And, of course, we owe her the legacy of bringing really good food to the table. I mean, my mother is a perfect example. She was a terrible cook. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening, but she was. I mean, she would make food that was tasted like sheetrock. And we watched Julia on Monday night where I grew up, and Tuesday we would get a gorgeous dinner on the table. We couldn't believe it. My mother transformed herself. That's what she brought to people. She took, you know, just normal, everyday people who didn't really know much about cooking and help them put really delicious food on the table and give them pride about what they were creating, which is really a remarkable thing.
You had the opportunity to travel with Julia Child in Sicily back in 1992. How did that come about?
You know, I was over there writing for six or seven American magazines, and I got a call from a friend at the Italian Trade Commission who said, we know you have a little extra time on your hand. Would you mind being an escort for an older woman? And I said, hey, I don't do that kind of work, lady. And they said, no, it's Julia Child. Julia was over there trying to make a tour of restaurants in Sicily and just to try to understand what kind of food it was. And she was 82 at the time. Her knees were giving out, and she needed a young arm to hold on to while she went to these restaurants and ate. And I was that guy. I mean, it was such a lucky thing for me because for almost a month, I did nothing but eat and talk with Julia Child. And it was at a time when she was ready to reflect on her life, not just about who she was, but about what she had brought, as you had asked before, Craig, to our culture and to the country and her legacy. So I was lucky. I ran a tape recorder and got about 50 or 60 hours of wonderful recollections from her, and it formed the basis of Deary.
So did you know at that time, I'm doing a biography of this woman?
You know, when we got back, I told her I wanted to.
Okay.
She was engaged with another person at that point, and she called me about 3 months later and said, you know, I'm really unhappy with the way this book is turning out. Please reconsider. I would urge you to reconsider. And at the time, in those short months, I had gotten involved with the Beatles, and in a book which I thought would take 2 years to write, took almost 9 years. So by that time, unfortunately, Julia had died. And after it was finished, after the Beatles were finished, I knew that my next project would be this biography.
What in all of the research that you did most surprised you as you examined Julia Child's life?
I think it was the fact that this woman could not, at age of 40, could not cook. She couldn't even boil water. At the age of 50, she had never been on TV and didn't even own a TV. 1 year later, she goes on TV and she becomes Julia Child and transforms herself at midlife. And I think to watch that, to see how that happens in that short time was, for me, one of the biggest treats of all. And I find that the most remarkable part of her life.
Bob Spitz is the author of several books, including the bestseller The Beatles. His latest is entitled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob, thanks for talking with us today.
Craig, it's been a treat. Thank you.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. You'll find our program post there, and you're always welcome to post a comment there. You can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. Let folks who are unable to listen at 10 a.m. weekday mornings know about our rebroadcast weeknights at 8. On tomorrow's show, the National Hockey League is currently deep in a labor dispute that has led to the cancellation of some games and could threaten the entire season. This fall, football fans were up in arms as the National Football League used replacement referees that, well, frankly, botched a number of calls while the league negotiated a new contract with the regular refs. Last year, the NBA played a shortened season following a protracted dispute between the players and owners. Why so much labor management strife in professional sports where the players are often millionaires and the owners are billionaires and everyone seems to be making money? Who loses in these disputes? Do they reflect attitudes towards labor and management in society at large? Or is this just a case of the very rich versus the super rich? And ultimately, why should we care? We'll discuss recent labor disputes in professional sports and what, if anything, they tell us about today's society with Michael LeRoy, professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations and the College of Law at the University of Illinois. That's on tomorrow's program. Hope you can tune in then. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.